This is Writer's Voice. Today, we continue our two-part series about undocumented immigrant youth in America. Last week, we spoke with Stephanie Canizales about her book, Sin Padres Ni Papeles, Unaccompanied Migrant Youth Coming of Age in the United States. Today, we talk with Rafael Martinez about his book, Illegalized, Undocumented Youth Movements in the United States. Then we play an extended excerpt from one of our 10 favorite episodes of 2024, our conversation with sociologist Eric Kleinenberg about his book, 2020. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice, in-depth conversation with writers of all genres, on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station, your favorite podcast app, or at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Rafael Martinez was born in Mexico and raised on the streets of South Central Los Angeles. As an undocumented immigrant, he lived a life of insecurity and restrictions, always seeking to stay under the radar of the immigration authorities. That continued until DACA gave him legitimacy in the eyes of the law. DACA enabled Martinez to attend graduate school and eventually become a professor of Southwest Borderlands at Arizona State University, where he continues his work to empower migrant communities. His book, Illegalized, takes readers on a journey through the history of the rise of undocumented youth movements in the United States in the 21st century. In our conversation, Martinez tells us about how the stigma of illegality affects the daily life of undocumented migrant youth, and he sheds light on the systemic challenges they face. But he also shares stories of the resilience they forged through collective action. Let's listen now. Rafael Martinez, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you for having me, Francesca.
Now, you were born in Mexico, and you came to the United States as a very young child with your parents. So you spent your youth undocumented. You say that that early experience was determined by what you call your illegality. What impact did that illegality have on your life until really it changed when you went to college?
You know, I think oftentimes when people talk about illegality, both in academic, scholarly terms, but just in general in the public sphere, people often think about the big picture items, which are important, the borderlands, detention, deportation, those big things. But in the book, I talk about illegality as something that happens in everyday actions for undocumented immigrants in the United States in the decision-making process that undocumented immigrants have to make on a daily basis, but specifically for youth and children growing up undocumented, as I did myself for, you know, practically half of my life. As you come of age, you see your friends getting their driver's license. You see them benefiting from the material culture that the United States often promises our youth, right? Getting their all of these different trips, all of these different actions. And growing up undocumented, you're limited. You're limited in terms of mobility. When I grew up in the state of California, California at that time didn't have driver's licenses for undocumented immigrants. So I was not able to receive a driver's license when all of my friends were getting their driver's license. That restricted me from enjoying all the things that youth enjoy, going to the movies, going out on dates, hanging out with friends. All of those different actions are limiting. Now, when it came time to going to college, it impacted education as well, because you know, many people were going away to college to different states, different universities. And I might have been a competitive student, but, you know, my reality was I'm going to go to a university that's A, affordable, and B, that's closest to my house, because, again, I can't even drive to my university. And so all of those things are impacted. And I wouldn't get all of these benefits until I was much older, already in my late 20s. and healthcare, you know, all of those different things that a lot of U.S. citizens, of course, take for granted or are inherited privileges, if you will. Those are the ways that I talked about illegality, is having to make those everyday actions on how undocumented immigrants navigate everyday decision-making process.
You went to college, and was in-state tuition free when you began, or did that change while you were there? That I'm talking about undergrad.
Yeah, for my undergrad, I received in-state tuition. And, you know, in California at the time, we had what was known as AB 540, and that granted undocumented students in-state tuition. Now, of course, that had come from a long period of activism and organizing in California and really around the United States as well, stemming back all the way from the 1980s and really the 90s, where things intensified. And then states like Texas, believe it or not, Texas was the first state to grant in-state tuition to undocumented students. And then California would follow, New Mexico, and quite a bit of states now that offer in-state tuition. Of course, quite a bit of them that have also gone the opposite direction and not granted in-state tuition. California, for example, now also has state aid for undocumented students, as does New Mexico and many other states around the nation. But at the time, yes, I qualified for in-state tuition, but did not receive state aid yet. That came much later after some more organizing in the early 2000s. And basically, it would be my parents and I that paid for tuition out of pocket.
And organizing is a key factor in your book, Illegalized Undocumented Youth Movements in the United States. It must be dismaying to see so much backsliding, even in those states. I mean, Texas, of course. And we'll talk more about this later, but just what were some of the privileges that you enjoyed that are now being lost?
Well, you know, I think one of the important things that I talk about in the book is that oftentimes in the United States, even in social movements and spaces of organizing, there's this illusion that there's a starting place and then there's going to be an ending place and things are going to run linear. Like, you start at a place and things are going to naturally get better. And in some ways, they oftentimes do, but that really finish line becomes blurry because power, you know, in this case, governmental power, institutional power adapts to, you know, resistance or organizing efforts. And we saw that happening within the broader immigrant rights movement and certainly undocumented youth social movements, where there was this intensified period of the 2000s, which is the primary period that I write about in telling the history of how undocumented youth became the face of the broader immigrant rights movement and changed the way that we talked about immigrant rights. In that period of time, we saw in-state tuition, as I mentioned, in many states, you know, change, the discourse change in those states, driver's license beginning to be offered in many places. And then, of course, the biggest, you know, win, if you will, in some ways for undocumented youth was the passing of Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA, under President Obama's administration, where in June of 2012, under an executive action, he granted DACA, which allowed undocumented youth to gain a work permit and, you know, lack of fear of deportation or protection from deportation. And that was a permit that would be renewed every 2 years by undocumented youth. And again, that wasn't something that was given. That was something that was granted based on all the organizing, the efforts, the push by undocumented youth. But unfortunately, you know, over time, you know, we've gone from discussions about immigration reform, about supporting undocumented youth and our broader immigrant rights population, to now basically, you know, the idea of immigration reforms now sounds so foreign in political terms. And we see that DACA is now in a vulnerable position where, under the 45th president's administration, it was pushed to legality, and now it's in the court systems, which, with him coming back as 47th president, we see DACA, you know, in a very precarious state and might not be making it this next 4 years.
And you are also a dreamer. That changed your life when you were in graduate school, as I I recollect. Is that correct?
That's correct, yes. As I mentioned, my undergrad experience was completely undocumented. And, you know, that was a challenging experience that lasted 8 years, essentially, because at that time, there was no point in graduating. There was no next step, no career option. And really, graduate school seemed like a safe bet or a sanctuary in the sense of thinking about, okay, well, I'll just prolong my education. And of course, I was passionate about reading and writing, as I would continue to do in graduate school. And that's really what led me to my master's and PhD. And then, you know, once I started my master's program in 2012, that's when DACA passed, and that completely changed the game. You know, that gave me access to a work permit, that gave me access to protection from deportation. And then for the first time, you know, reaching 27 years old, I had a driver's license in the state of New Mexico. And then I also had healthcare for the first time in my life in general. And so, you know, my experience from undergrad to graduate school and really the adult part of my life now as a professor has been completely, you know, different from, you know, my youth, essentially.
And is that threatened if something happens to DACA?
Certainly.
Oh, wow.
Certainly, yes. If DACA was to go away the day of tomorrow, of course, not only my job, but at the height of DACA, we had 800,000 undocumented youth participate or benefit from DACA. Currently, the program has about 500,000 youth. A lot of the reason for people not subscribing or continuing with the program was under the 45th President's administration. Of course, not only was the threat they would end DACA, but also that the collection of data from DACA, right, would lead to basically mass deportations. And so many people would not renew their DACA, did not renew their DACA. And so we're currently at about 500,000 undocumented youth. And I say that number because that's in contrast to the larger 11 million undocumented immigrants living in the United States today. And so, yes, you know, DACA is very important. It has allowed people like myself and other folks to pursue our career, to give back to this country, to be contributing members of society in very key places. Me in education, many people, as we saw during the years of the pandemic, contributing in the realm of being essential workers during our country and the world's hard time during COVID. And so we see that, you know, the impact of DACA would be massive in terms of, you know, millions of dollars that would be cut and contributing by DACA recipients to this country.
You're saying that people actually dropped out of the DACA system because they feared that it was going to go away and then they would be more vulnerable. It sounds like there, and you say in your book, that there are actually some advantages that come with being undocumented.
Well, yes. You know, I think that the advantages is, you know, and of course, as we face this threat of DACA being rescinded, as we face, you know, possible new political challenges by the new administration coming in, you know, people are resourceful, immigrant communities are resilient, and that resilience has to bring creativity. It has to bring new ways of living, new ways of adapting to a system. And so many scholars, including myself in my book, we write about this idea of how undocumented youth and how undocumented immigrants it can be creative in the realm of challenges. And this is not new. Of course, we see this in many historical periods where there's repression, there's ways of adaptation. But the other thing that we should say, or caution, I should say, is that, you know, resilience is a double-edged sword. So there's resilience and creativity and all the great things that come from this status and marginalization. But also there's still marginalization, meaning that there's still trauma, there's still PTSD, there's still a lot of mental health issues and health issues that undocumented immigrants carry, because living in that precarious state for so many years, for so long of years, is just something that is quite stressful. And that stress eventually leads to chronic health issues and mental health issues. So There's the positives, of course, and then also the challenges.
Yes, and Rafael Martinez, the kind of trauma that you describe, I mean, even just on the level of always having to watch your back, be careful about not getting into situations where your undocumented status could come to light, that is incredibly stressful. But now, as you chronicle in Illegalized, Undocumented Youth Movements in the United States, coming out publicly as undocumented is one of these creative adaptations, I guess you could say, to me, who watched it when it was going on. It seemed an incredible act of courage. So talk about how these movements of undocumented youth began and evolved, and this whole policy of going public, how people do that. I mean, not just on the most basic level. How do they do that and yet still are able to maintain their activism?
One of the things that I point to in the book is the fact that most of the organizers and leaders in undocumented youth social movements that I write about were, of course, trained for many years and worked with many organizations that stem from the civil rights movement and other justice-based movements, civil disobedience tactics and strategies. And so things like coming out of the shadows, which means undocumented youth, very in public ways, coming out publicly and denouncing their undocumented status, comes, for example, from like the coming out of the closet that the queer or LGBTQ rights movement of the 60s, 70s organized to make space, to create space, right? If people know that you're undocumented, it creates, you know, a space or an opportunity for other folks to be seen, to be heard, and to know that there's other folks going through similar experiences. But also it lets people know that in numbers, there's strength. And I remember when I started watching these videos and these actions online, mostly on social media, as MySpace, Facebook, and all of these social media were coming to fruition in the early 2000s. For me, myself, you know, many of us grew up saying, don't share your status. You might get detained. You might get deported. Don't say anything to anybody. And so when I'm watching these videos, it begs the question internally within our own community to say, Should I be doing these similar things to be able to open up that space, if it's publicly or even privately, for other folks within my university, within my church group, within my, like, different groups, right? Different settings for people to feel seen, to be heard, and to be acting. And so that was one thing that changed the game or flipped the script for undocumented youth that was different from earlier immigrant rights movement, where it was mostly people advocating on behalf of immigrants. The way that youth changed, the way that the undocumented youth movement went forward, was that, no, we're going to control our own narrative, and we're going to put our own messaging out there, and we're going to develop our own organizations. Now, by the time that we reached 2010, you know, the cultural capital, the social fabric of the United States, undocumented youth became so seen, so heard, and so favorable by the general U.S. public, that detaining and deporting these activists, even when they pushed the boundaries, even when they came out in very public ways, or they conducted civil disobedience actions that were very public, would have been seen very unfavorable by the U.S. public. And that alone was also a tactic that undocumented youth learned from earlier periods. You know, one of the things I talk about in chapter one is the sanctuary movement, a new sanctuary movement. The sanctuary movement, of course, stemming from the 1980s with refugees and asylum cases coming to the United States. But the sanctuary movement began not with immigrants, but it originally stemmed from the Vietnam era, where conscientious objector from the Vietnam War era were basically rejecting their draft cases, and they started taking sanctuary inside of churches. And initially, the U.S. government was basically pulling these individuals out of churches, and the public outcry became so big that the U.S. government stopped doing that as a practice of, like, drafting people in these public ways. And so later on, when the sanctuary movement began, people began to adopt these strategies and saying, this is going to be seen very unfavorable by the U.S. public. And so immigrant rights continued some of these same actions. And by the time that we get to 2010 with undocumented youth, they're seen so favorable by the U.S. public that they exchange that cultural capital to really serve as a protection layer, where they're now pushing the boundaries of organizing and organizing very publicly and in civil disobedience ways, because they know they're more likely not going to get detained and deported. And in fact, most of the cases that I write about, or leaders that I write about in the book, most of those undocumented youth don't get detained and deported.
Some of those leaders that you write about were Jonathan Perez and Isaac Barrera. They founded the Immigrant Youth Coalition, and one of their actions early on was walking into a Border Patrol office in order to get detained. Tell us about that incident. What happened? Why did they do that? And then tell us about the work of that coalition.
Well, in 2011, when Jonathan and Isaac decided to take on this action, they realized, you know, our undocumented immigrant communities, we knew firsthand the violence that was happening inside of detention centers. And we knew it because, of course, unfortunately, our loved ones and people in our communities were suffering from this violence when they were detained inside of detention centers. But of course, detention centers, for people or the public who might not be aware, detention centers are kind of situated in places that are out of sight and out of mind, and really hard places to get to, even for lawyers who have cases or who have clients there. And so it was really hard to document that violence and human rights violations that were happening inside of the detention centers. And it took very much this courageous act, or this way of pushing the boundaries of organizing, for these folks to decide, okay, we're going to risk our own deportation. We're going to get detained. We're going to go ahead and perform this and get detained so that we could infiltrate the detention center. That's the way that we could get access to the detention center. So they did. And of course, it was all a coordinated effort, meaning that everything was strategized. There had been multiple organizations involved. You mentioned the IYC, but there was also NIA, the National Immigrant Youth Alliance. That was a network, a national network of leaders who were intending to do these type of disruptive civil disobedient actions that were pushing the boundaries, along with allied lawyers who would work their cases, of course, once they were inside of detention. And so once they were placed inside of the detention center, they started interviewing, they started talking to people inside of detention. And the two important things that they found that they would later call activists on the outside and lawyers at the outside would be basically audio recording those conversations so that they could document or share those experiences that they were finding inside with the public outside, and disseminating those through social media, through media networks. And so this went what we would call today viral, where people were like catching on to this actions that were happening. The two things that they found inside of the detention center: one was that the administration at that point was telling us that we are only deporting high criminals or high profile cases. We're not pursuing low infractions. And in fact, the majority of the people that they were finding inside of that detention center were low infraction offenders, right? Like things like people crossing the sidewalk or jaywalking, things like people running a red light or something like that. And then the second thing they were finding was that it was very common experience for many of those folks to have experienced a form of violence, a form of mental health or health negligence inside of detention. And so, you know, they would spend, you know, some time inside of that detention center reporting out to the outside world what was happening in. And I don't want to spoil it for your audience. I want them to read the chapter, but basically, what I will say is that to the U.S. government, these two activists that are infiltrating the detention center become a bigger threat inside of the detention center than outside of that detention center, because they are basically exposing the U.S. government and showcasing what's really happening inside of detention center. And it begs the question, and really why I named the book Illegalized, is it shows how undocumented bodies or immigrants are rendered illegal in places like detention centers. But it begs the question to be asked, is it these undocumented immigrants who come to the U.S. to make a better life who are the illegal or committing illegal actions? Or is it the U.S. government who's basically going through this energy and effort to document undocumented immigrants as criminals and then putting them through these violent patterns inside of the detention center, who is the illegal one for committing these human rights violations?
Yes, and Rafael Martinez, you mentioned that it was, maybe this was in the Obama administration. Anyway, it was claimed that only the worst of the worst were being deported. And of course, that was shown not to be true, as you just said. Talk a little bit about the through line between, you know, the Obama administration, the Trump administration, the Biden administration, before we talk about what might be the same or different in the Trump administration.
That's a really great question, because I think one of the evolutions of undocumented youth social movements through those administrations that you name and mention, you know, initially people or undocumented youth were still willing to, in some ways, work with the system, meaning support certain politicians and many times even publicly advocating or campaigning with them to say, you know, if we put this person in office, the outcome might be more favorable. And in some cases, that was generally true. However, undocumented youth over the evolution of the 2000s and really going into the present moment, we have come to realize that the issue is not always just who's in office. The issue is the immigration control system that is designed. You know, people say the immigration system is broken. Many of us would argue that it's not broken. Unfortunately, it's performing what it was meant to do, which it's meant to be a violent system. It's meant to produce money or capital, right? Because let's not forget that, you know, these detention centers are private detention centers and therefore profit. And so at the end of the day, whoever is in office, they have a contract with these private detention centers that tells them you need to fill these beds in order for us to continue to renew these contracts. So no matter who's in office, that cycle needs to continue. That machinery needs to continue. And the oversight that happens is that no matter who's in office, these are private detention centers. So when lawyers or community members go to complain about the system, in reality, that's how the U.S. government washes their hands by saying, well, it's not the U.S. government committing these actions. It's these privately run detention centers, and you need to complain with them, right? So there's so much oversight that happens. And so the big difference is that we saw, for example, right now in the transition between the Biden administration going into the 47th president's administration, that there's things that the Biden administration could be taking to potentially reduce the potential harm that could be done in the next administration. And we see the opposite happening, where basically the opportunities for, you know, ramping up detentions and deportations as an immigration system have continued, and those numbers just continue to stay steadily high across those administrations. And so I think that oftentimes we think of this as an administration issue or like a president being in power, but it's really a systems issue, because while the immigration system continues with these violent oversights, these, you know, different rules and regulations, those oversights are going to continue to happen no matter who's in office.
So, as you point out, this is systemic. And I want to step outside the frame that we seem to have been in since 9/11, which is that we have to control our borders. I mean, even though, you know, 9/11 happened with a whole bunch of people from Saudi Arabia that we have never gone after, the U.S. has always seen itself as a country of immigrants. Our economy completely depends on the labor of immigrants, whether that's in food or, as you pointed out, essential workers. I mean, we saw that. Why do we need to control our borders? I mean, I just need to ask that question. Why can't people just come across with, of course, a certain, we don't want to have people who are, you know, as Kamala Harris talked about, the drug cartels coming in. But why do we go from an assumption that we have to keep people out when we actually need people to come in?
Yes, that's a great question. And I think that's a question that most U.S. Americans need to reflect on. I'll give you two quick, you know, ideas or two quick historical reference points that I think I mentioned in the book, but also many scholars would agree on. And the first one is that if you go back to the 1980s, we tend to think of this militarization of the border as something that has gone on for generations and many years. In fact, you know, it's a very recent, you know, development. Really, it wasn't until the 90s or the late 1980s, the 90s and the 2000s that we see this high militarization of the border that we have here. And that's significant because up to the 80s, 70s, and 60s, people would generally still be able to walk or come across those borders with particular ease, right? And the idea that was sold to the Americans was that we need to protect and militarize these borders because there's drugs, there's guns, there's terrorists, there's all these things happening across the borders. But in fact, really what was happening is people would come to the United States and work for X amount of years, make enough money to send back home. And most of those time, by the time those folks, you know, had enough money to start back in their home countries, many of them would return, you know, and successfully return back to their home countries. But when the 90s, the militarization of the border began or really ramped up, that's when we saw, you know, people being landlocked, people having to make the decision. If we're going to migrate to the U.S., it's to stay there. And we see this from the last immigration reform, which was in 1986. We haven't had one since then. There was only about 3 million to 4 million undocumented immigrants in the U.S. at that time. Now we fast forward and we're at 11 million. Why? Because people are landlocked. If they migrate to the U.S., they have to stay here. They can't go back to their home countries for the most part. So that's an important fact for people to realize that that's what you're giving up by militarizing the border and keeping people locked in. The second thing that happens is that, again, detention became a big item of capital for the United States. I mean, you're talking about in the millions, if not going into billions now, of revenue that the U.S. government, like any military contract or any of those type of contracts, it has these big contracts. And, you know, many scholars, my book talks a little bit about return migration or undocumented youth who have been detained and deported back to their home countries. And what we see with returned migrants to Latin America, to Mexico, is that the majority of those folks speak English. So where are they working once they go back to their home countries? They're working for American companies, right? And so the system's still working even then, right? And then with new immigrants coming and being long landlocked in the United States and continue to be undocumented for many generations, many years, what ends up happening is you maintain a revolving door that guarantees low wage workers for basically decades, right? And that's what we see. Americans don't want to see undocumented immigrants in their community, but they sure enjoy the service that they provide because otherwise most industries in this country would fall apart. And if we are talking about mass deportation, people are going to come to reckon with that reality pretty quickly if that actually goes through.
I want to ask you, what is the most important thing that people like myself or listeners listening to this program who are American citizens can do to support their neighbors who could be in such dire danger?
Well, you know, that's a great question. And I would say that as my book shows and in my work documents, is that people, undocumented immigrants, but certainly allies like yourself and your listeners, should get involved. And what that means is there's tons of local organizations that do work for immigrant rights, that work with our immigrant led. And so right now, with this challenge of a new administration coming in, people should get involved with these organizations. Those organizations will tell folks what the needs are, right, around labor issues, around detention and deportation defense system. Most of these organizations have already built detention and deportation defense systems. There's going to be a high need for legal accompanying to possible, you know, court cases and things of this situation. You know, a lot of our youth are going through very hard mental health issues. You know, people who have access to some of these resources, you know, like our lawyers, many times they're working for pro bono for these communities, you know, for mental health and healthcare providers to be able to support our undocumented immigrants in these important ways, or educators to be compassionate, because yes, undocumented immigrants could be impacted. But one of the important facts that I'll remind your listeners as well is that there's an expected about 18 million U.S. children living with undocumented parents. So whatever might happen the day of tomorrow not only impacts our undocumented immigrant community, but it certainly impacts our U.S. citizens, including our U.S. born children who have parents or family members who might be impacted by whatever actions might be taken. So there's different ways, but the most important thing that I'll tell your listeners is to get involved with their local organizations. And, you know, a lot of these folks will tell them you could get involved in these different ways and support our undocumented immigrants in these different ways as well.
Well, Rafael Martinez, I wish we could spend more time on this wonderful book, Illegalized: Undocumented Youth Movements in the United States. But you've already given us much to think about and to act on. And I want to thank you so much for talking with us here.
Thank you. I enjoyed our conversation.
Rafael Martinez is assistant professor of Southwest Borderlands at Arizona State University. Next up, a look back at 2020. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. As we go into 2025, it might be a good idea to take a look back at 2020, one of the most consequential years in American history. It just might have been the year Americans lost faith with their government, with consequences we continue to experience. That's what sociologist Eric Kleiningberg told us when we spoke with him back in May of 2024 about his acclaimed book, 2020, One City, Seven People, and the Year Everything Changed. Through the stories of seven New Yorkers, Kleiningberg reveals how citizens stepped up when institutions failed during the pandemic, the protests, and economic upheaval. It's a lesson we would do well to remember as we enter an era when the incoming administration is hell-bent on shredding whatever is left of the federal government's capacity to serve our needs. Let's listen to an edited version of our conversation with Eric Kleiningberg about his book, 2020. This book, 2020, you talk about it not only in terms of the year itself, but also 2020 vision looking backward. COVID is still with us. We're only 2 years from the last serious wave with the Omicron variant. Over 1.1 million Americans have died. Yet nobody talks about it anymore. You say we need our day of reckoning. What do you mean by that?
Something incredibly powerful happened to us. I mean, we experienced a series of traumas in 2020 that inevitably shaped us. And, you know, of course, COVID and the pandemic is a big part of that, but it's not the only thing. And the book 2020 is also about the economic crisis where millions of people lost their jobs and the markets crashed, and people felt a kind of economic security that they hadn't in generations. And the book is also about the murder of George Floyd and this fact of police violence and structural racism shaping American life in ways that we sometimes avoid grappling with. The book is about the abandonment of cities. It's about the spike in violence that happened in the United States, almost uniquely in the world, at a time when most countries were able to kind of come together and achieve some level of solidarity to get through the threats. And the book is also about the attack on democracy and democratic institutions in the US. All those things happened just a couple of years ago. And I think we need a reckoning because we are suffering today from a kind of long COVID, not the medical condition, but long COVID as a kind of social disease. The distrust and the division and this dispirited nature of American collective life all got more intense and more durable during that year. And I think we see long COVID as a social problem show up in all kinds of things in our world today in 2024. I think that it's shaping our politics. I think it's going to shape our election. It shapes our culture wars. It's shaping life on college campuses this year. And so I wrote the book as an invitation for us to face up to it and to talk about what we live through and to reckon, because if we don't, it's not like the thing isn't there. It's just acting out on us like something we've repressed, but is deep inside of our bodies and minds.
And why do you think we have repressed it so intensely? I mean, this is not the first time that, well, not just Americans, but that people have forgotten an epidemic almost as soon as it has died down. I mean, I think the same thing happened in 1918, but it's really bizarre and eerie to see it happen so quickly. We lost so many people. Why do you think people are practicing this kind of amnesia?
Well, you're right. It's a repeated pattern. In fact, one of the best books about the 1918 flu influenza pandemic is called America's Forgotten Pandemic. And I think we could think about this in a couple different levels. First of all, you know, at a human level, it was a little overwhelming to be alive in 2020 and absorbing everything and grappling with everything. I mean, for a lot of us, it was scary to have COVID in the world. We, you know, a lot of people felt like they were suddenly vulnerable in new ways. They didn't know if they would survive. They didn't know if their parents would survive. They didn't know what would happen to their kids. They didn't know what happened to their jobs. A lot of people got sick and had to deal with the repercussions of that. A lot of people did lose loved ones and close friends. So often when that happens to us, our impulse is to, you know, try to put the bad feelings in a black box and kind of soldier on and get through it and move to the next thing. And I do think that at some psychological level, it was just too much for a lot of individuals to bear, the pressure of the moment. And it's a hugely unpleasant experience, if not downright scary, for a lot of people. And so I just think psychologically, one of our defense mechanisms was to put it out of sight. You know, we have this will not to know. But then I also think that 2020 and COVID in particular as political events are really tricky. You know, as we know, on the right, there was a strong effort to downplay the significance of the disease, in some cases to deny that it was anything more than the flu. We were urged to move on and to stop whining about it by many. And so I think for many on the political right, COVID stands today as this manufactured crisis. They insist that it was exaggerated, that we overreacted. And so they want to push us to move on. And then I think for Democrats, COVID also represents a kind of problem because in some ways, President Biden overpromised what he could deliver. You know, he promised that the pandemic would end. It didn't end right away. He was more optimistic you know, than you probably should have been, that the vaccines would just make the thing go away. And so it's hard for the Democrats to run on their success managing the health crisis after 2021, because although 2020 was far more chaotic and dysregulated and disorderly, and I think ultimately 2020 did much more damage, and our political leaders did much more damage in 2020. The failure to just get rid of the COVID crisis and get things back to normal haunts the Democratic Party today. And so they're not, for the most part, all that interested in running on it either. And I think for those reasons, I think that's part of why we're just more comfortable pushing it away than looking at it closely. The book, as you know, is organized around the stories of seven really different people from different walks of life with different political views. One person from every borough of New York City, you know, plus a Black Lives Matter activist, and the story of a subway worker who died very early in the crisis, an immigrant from India. And I think what unites the stories is the through line of each person feeling abandoned by core institutions at a time of need, of being left, you know, on their own to solve whatever personal problems and collective problems we faced. And, you know, eventually in the US, much later than other places, but eventually we developed a system for, you know, making people more secure. There were stimulus payments, there were payments to keep some businesses afloat. The most dramatic and important policy that we used to improve people's lives during the pandemic was the Child Poverty Reduction Act, which reduced child poverty in the US by record numbers, lifting more than 5 million kids out of poverty at this time of great peril. And then what happened within a year or so is that all of those measures, which were meant to create a safety net, were pulled out from under American voters. And you're right to say that, you know, the reason is that Manchin and Sinema and the entire Republican Party are responsible for our failure to extend those measures and for our failure to build out more with these really ambitious infrastructure and climate and jobs proposal that the Biden administration worked tirelessly to push through. But in the real politics, you know, I think most American voters don't care who specifically is responsible. They see it as a collective failure of Congress and government, and they see it as specific failure of leadership in the White House. And so there is this widespread feeling in the United States of being distrustful of government, of feeling like, you know, that they're not going to be there for us. And I think Americans felt that most acutely and powerfully during 2020, and the book documents the extent to which our kind of chaotic leadership from the White House down really imperiled the lives of Americans and fostered the spirit of division and distrust, which are long-term legacies of that year. But unfortunately, we haven't done nearly as much as we could to sustain gains or to rebuild trust in the years after. I think that's part of why things feel so fraught and explosive today as we head into the summer of 2024, you know, fearing what's ahead.
Yeah. Terrifying. And if you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Eric Kleinenberg about his latest book, 2020, One City, Seven People, and the Year Everything Changed. Yeah, so these seven New Yorkers, you tell different pieces of the story through them. And so let's start with the disparities in healthcare resources in hospitals and nursing homes, by the way. Tell us about Sophia Zayas. She worked for Governor Cuomo, and we should note, despite him, you know, being a so-called pandemic hero or touting himself as one, he made some really devastating decisions in the beginning. So tell us about her first, and then talk about Cuomo's initial response as well as the response of Bill de Blasio.
Well, so Sophia Zayas is, you know, one of the seven characters. She's a, you know, wonderful person who was the Bronx regional representative for Governor Cuomo's office in 2020. And her job involved making sure that institutions in the Bronx had the resources they needed to continue their work and to support people. And those institutions included the hospitals, which, you know, of course, in the early weeks of the pandemic were completely overwhelmed. They didn't have PPE. They didn't have ventilators. They didn't have bays to store all the dead bodies from people in the Bronx who were dying. And Sophia's job was to work overtime 7 days a week to get everything she possibly could for her community. And, you know, the chapter about Sophia is called 24 hours a day. And that's basically what her work responsibilities felt like. She's from the Bronx. She lives in a housing complex in the heart of the Bronx, and it's a, you know, working class neighborhood. She had several neighbors die, including her next door neighbor and very close friend. Her grandfather lived across the street, and he survived COVID, but had a number of people, I think seven in his building, die early in the early days. She could hear the sirens all the time. I mean, she was totally inundated in this world. And, you know, through her, one gets the sense of just what it felt like, I think, to be at the heart of this crisis. And New York City was really the epicenter of the world. It was the hottest spot on Earth for quite some time. And the Bronx was one of the deadliest places you could be in New York. And the, you know, the difficulty for Sophia also, I should note, is that, you know, she was scared for her own life and for the life of her family. And also, like many Americans, and especially like a lot of Black and Latino Americans, somewhat skeptical of the medical establishment. And so, you know, one really salient part of Sophia's story is that when the vaccines finally came out, a big part of her job was trying to get the vaccine distributed in the Bronx. And Cuomo, in one of his better moments, prioritized getting the vaccine available to residents of the Bronx because it was so hard hit by the pandemic, and because he was concerned about inequalities, meaning that, you know, poor neighborhoods and Black neighborhoods would have less access to the vaccine. So he prioritized distribution of the vaccine. But Sophia herself is afraid of the vaccine and skeptical that maybe it's being tested on, you know, Black and poor communities, because more affluent and powerful communities are, you know, want to see what happens first. So she is charged with this responsibility of distributing a vaccine that she doesn't trust. And the personal drama that she lives with and the stress of managing that situation, I think, is, it really speaks to underlying concerns that, you know, are a big part of the American story. When we don't trust our scientists, and we don't trust our government health agencies, and we don't trust each other, we become really dysfunctional on multiple levels. And Sophia's story speaks to that.
I want to turn to another, I think, very important theme in this book, and that is that in the wake of, in the face of this massive failure of the authorities to protect the public health, ordinary people, ordinary neighborhoods stepped up to develop incredibly important initiatives of mutual aid. Tell us about Nuala O'Doherty and the COVID Care Neighbor Network.
Yeah, I'm so glad you brought up this theme, because for me, it's one of the most important ones and one of the most hopeful ones in the book. Nuala is how I pronounce her name, is a spark plug. She is Irish American from a family of immigrants. She is the only one born in the U.S. She's married to an Ecuadorian auto technician. They have lived in Queens for decades. She went to law school at St. John's. They met in a bodega in Astoria. They live in Jackson Heights, Queens, which is one of the most amazing, diverse neighborhoods on Earth. There's something like 160 languages spoken in Jackson Heights. It's a very densely populated working-class immigrant community. A lot of crowded apartments, a lot of people who are part of the cash economy, informal labor sector. And when COVID started, Nuala, who'd worked as a district attorney for 30 years, had just retired, and she was, you know, starting a campaign for a very local political office. And she realized that, you know, her community was going to be in crisis, that the virus was going to spread, that there are lots of people who are going to have to work and they're part of the essential workforce, and they'd go out and expose themselves to the disease. And she also knew that there were lots of people in Jackson Heights living in crowded apartments who would be transmitting the disease to the people they shared a home with. And anticipating that, and also anticipating the economic crisis from people losing their jobs, she decided to put out this poster, which she did. She hand wrote a note and had her kids Xerox it and posted around the neighborhood. And it said, you know, if you need help, call me. And she put on her mobile phone number. And within a couple of days, hundreds of people were calling her asking for help. And she was a little overwhelmed. So she then came up with another idea, which is to put out a poster saying, if you can offer help, call me. And she put down the same number. And again, hundreds of people called because they wanted to do something. And so within a week or so, Nuala and her neighbors had started this thing they called the COVID Care Neighborhood Network. And it's one of countless examples of mutual aid networks that Americans started, and really people around the world started during 2020, to support each other, to provide essential resources and support at a time when, you know, government was acting too slowly. And in Nuala's case, that meant procuring food and diapers and cleaning supplies and, you know, arranging for people to come and pick them up. And then when the volunteer base built up enough, getting people to go around and hand deliver them to folks who weren't comfortable going out of their apartment. And then some people had service needs, which her network began to provide. And you just see this neighborhood band together and bond together to do something really beautiful that I think is also in keeping with this tradition of American volunteerism. So we talk a lot about the hyper-individualism that made America such a dangerous and deadly place. But there's this other tradition of America, which is about participation and civic engagement. And over the course of the, you know, multi-year pandemic, the COVID Care Neighborhood Network did all kinds of things to make local life easier for people in Jackson Heights. They provided all tens of thousands of meals, all kinds of care services. They helped people get healthcare. They helped people get registered to get the vaccine. They started a campaign to create an open street that, you know, basically to turn a big boulevard in Jackson Heights into a park, an open street, like it closed to traffic because they didn't have access to green space and they needed a public place. And by the way, I reached out to Nuala recently to find out how she's doing. And it turns out that the same basement that was the staging ground for the COVID Care Neighborhood Network during COVID is now the headquarters for the Jackson Heights Immigration Center. And she and the same set of people are helping asylum seekers file their paperwork several days a week. And thousands of families have gone through them to get essentially pro bono legal assistance. So in some ways, it suggests that one kind of the brighter legacies of 2020 is that there is today this kind of invisible civic infrastructure that's all over American communities that's helping us get through the challenges of the moment. And as many difficulties as we have today, it's important to recognize that we haven't just separated and become distrustful. We've also built at the local level some incredibly powerful organizational resources for rebuilding and coming together again.
That was an excerpt from one of our 10 favorite episodes of 2024. Go to writersvoice.net for links to all of them. And make sure to listen, like, and subscribe. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Listen again for free, read book excerpts, and sign up for the podcast at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.